Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Deadline City. We are your hosts. I'm Zoraida Cordova.
And I'm Danielle Clayton.
Today, we have a very special guest with us, and we're going to the fantasy fields, like the fields of gold.
Oh, my God.
Like that song.
Why would you do this to her?
We're joined by Rebecca Rowan-Horace, one of my favorite authors, the author of Black Sun, Resistance Reborn, one of the best Star Wars novels that I've read recently, and so many other books, including middle grade and adult contemporary fantasy. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
We are so thrilled to have you deal with our shenanigans in Deadline City because we love you. You're one of my favorite people on this planet. And so I'm just so excited that I get to talk to you about all things fantasy. But in specifically, I want to have a discussion with both of you about fantasy world building when we're not pulling from sort of these overwhelming European sources, right? How do we create secondary worlds, contemporary fantasy, without always pulling from those wells? When the pressure is on, I feel the pressure to just, medieval Europe is the insert for fantasy. It becomes the sort of like default, just like whiteness is the default. It is this the fantasy default. So I want to talk about this and how we do it, because you do it so masterfully, especially in Black Sun, which has me stressed. I need book two. So first off, let's talk about world building and how we world build without using those analogs.
Yeah. Well, I could talk to you a little bit about my process and maybe Perfect. That would sort of help. But, you know, it is tough. I think particularly if you are a reader of fantasy, which every author should be if they're writing in the genre, you've read probably hundreds, you know, of these books. And so that medieval world, that sort of fake medieval world is just in your brain from childhood. Like I remember, I mean, some of my old favorites, the Dragonlance Chronicles, the Belgariad, gosh, even things like Susan Cooper, The Dark is Rising, you know, all of it takes place in like either Wales, you know, Wales, which is like a real Europe, or like a fake Europe, this medieval Europe. And it's so hard to break out of. So I have a lot of sympathy especially for writers of color who are trying to sort of reimagine fantasy worlds and keep feeling themselves getting stuck in these fake medieval Europes, because it is just sort of part of fantasy. But happily, that is changing a lot. You see a lot more authors writing from their own backgrounds, creating various types of, particularly like Asian secondary worlds, Asian-inspired secondary worlds, everything from South Asian to East Asian. You see a lot of African fantasy coming now. And of course, I'm trying to work in like indigenous fantasy of the Americas. So things are changing. Albeit slowly. And really, it's probably a small percentage of the books that are out there, you know, that are trying to do this as opposed to still, you know, medieval Europe sort of sells.
Yeah. I do think that this is something that we face in every genre, right? Whether it's contemporary or whether it's science fiction and fantasy. It is the idea that as soon as we have one West African fantasy, that's it. Like, One is enough. Like we're good on that. And I feel like that was a similar experience to the early days of YA contemporary, where you could have 70 Sweet 16 novels come out from the perspective of small town white girls, or like we have an ice cream shop by the beach, and like I have the best summer of my life, right? But as soon as you have more than one person of color writing in that space, all of a sudden it's like, oh, we have too many. So for me, I'm wondering, how derivative can things be? How original do they have to be? And how do we show readers and publishers that like look, you can have more than one option, right? Here's so many examples of how you can rewrite King Arthur in a different way. And we can write these West African fantasies in different ways, these Latin American fantasies in different way, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, you know, every author's voice is different, you know, and every perspective is going to be different as well. So just because it's been done once doesn't mean that, you know, now we can close the book. We've covered that topic. You know, there's so many different, you know, I'm going to write a very different book than, you know, someone else of my background's going to write and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's really frustrating. But, you know, you brought up the King Arthur retellings, and I think that that's a great point. Of course, you know, Tracy Dion's book, Legendborn, you know, yeah. I'm sure everybody's read that. Brilliant. I loved it. And I thought she did such a great job of sort of taking the familiar tropes of sort of King Arthur and of YA fantasy and then creating something new, adding to it by bringing in like root work and like, you know, African-American traditions and sort of weaving those in and making something really original. So I think you can have both. There's nothing wrong with Black and Indigenous and people of color, like the authors, the BIPOC authors, embracing and retelling the stories that they love and that they grew up with. And a lot of those are going to be of, you know, European origin, because that's, you know, particularly in America, that's really what we grew up hearing as well. And those stories belong to us too. They're part of our lives too. So I love this idea that you can take something like King Arthur and do a spin on it or do a retelling of it and put ourselves into the story. But then, you know, change it too, you know, to reflect that.
Yeah.
So I think that's one way you can approach that. And then, you know, the other way is to just throw it all out the window and try to create your own secondary world.
Which you've done amazingly.
I've definitely tried. I hope so. You know, it's not easy. It was really a challenge. You know, what I tried to do, so I've been obsessed sort of with like Mesoamerican cultures and Indigenous America's cultures, not just North America, including Mexico, but Central and South America as well. Forever. Like, this is just a topic of an area of interest for me. So I've been reading, you know, Aztec poetry and Maya creation stories and things like that forever. So I felt like I sort of had a grounding in what that sounded like and the sort of what that felt like. And I have, you know, sort of an Indigenous worldview as, you know, how I'm going to approach a subject, especially when it comes to issues of sexism or racism or gender identity. And so I tried to sort of bring all that together, because I think it's important when you're creating these worlds, not to just slap some brown paint on it or something and be like, oh, look, it's just like, you know, those characters might as well be white. Exactly. You know, you want to sort of dig into the worldview and what makes it different and what makes, you know, the culture what it is beyond just color. And I think that's really where BIPOC authors can excel in a way that sometimes white authors cannot. Because I think, you know, sometimes, not all, but sometimes they get a little lazy and they think really the difference is just skin color, when it's right. Not, you know, it's worldview, it's experience, it's all these different things that make us who we are that we bring to the page.
Can you talk about the cultural iceberg a little bit, Danielle?
Well, we did a whole episode sort of on it, thinking about when you see a person, you see what they're wearing, you see what they look like, and you can sort them sort of into what you think they are, who they are in their cosmology and what they believe about the world and their personal truths and their customs. But underneath the water is all of that culture and what informs that, why people wear what they wear, why they call their mother what they call their mother, why they're afraid of certain things. Like all of that other good stuff. And I really think that takes deep, deep work. There are no shortcuts to really creating compelling civilizations and fantasy worlds when you're creating outside of your own. Like, if you don't understand the stuff that's under the water, Jacqueline Woodson says, if you haven't been in my grandmother's kitchen and held the babies, then you don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're doing, because everything, right. That's the heart of the community and the culture. And that's where you get all of that stuff that's under the water. And I just feel like because of the way fantasy has been sort of made a thing, right, in the Western canon, and it has certain markers, certain iconography that is easily recognizable, when people of color show up to remix, to redo their own thing, we're given these tools that just feel like a mess, right? Mm. So here's the complaining portion of Deadline City, which I always provide, okay? every time I feel like when we enter a big secondary world, there are the brown people and they are from the village. Or if they are of the woods, they don't have any clothes, right? Or they are using sticks. And like, they're like, oh, right, because they live in the woods. They would have spears and they would use woodland, wood-based technology. And I'm like, yeah, and we can do more than that. Specifically, I'm bringing up The Witcher because Zoraida painfully made me watch that show.
I didn't make you do anything. Again. You watched it on your own, no. If I recall. I said, give it 3 episodes. And you were like, I have to keep watching it. I don't understand what's happening, but I have to keep watching it. And that's what happened.
And then so talk to Rebecca about when we get to the woods. What's in the woods, Zoraida?
Oh, in the woods are people wearing kind of like mossy loincloths, leather corseted, sort of moccasin-y kind of shoes, dreadlocks, even though they're white. like it is, and it is like it's a mix of people too. Like it's a white blonde woman, it's a black woman, it's an ethnically ambiguous woman. So I think that to circle back to like how we create these things, it is not enough to just make somebody brown and say they exist in my world, right? I think that authors have taken this idea of I'm going to be inclusive, therefore I'm going to pull everyone into my book without doing the deep thinking of that meta narrative of what that actually means, right? Mm-hmm. Because think about the power imbalances that exist in your fantasy world. Think about the geography that exists in your world, right? So I think that that kind of deep thinking is very hard. And it's not always comfortable. And so you have to answer the question, how do all of these people end up in the same tribe, right? Without even though they look so incredibly different, right? Where do they get their magic tree glowing magic?
From Magic Tree House.
Magic Tree House. I used to like that show.
Of course you did.
Wait, no. I'm thinking of the Magic School Bus. Never mind.
Oh my God. The Magic Tree House books. Those two little white kids get in that tree house and they go do a whole bunch of shit.
I didn't read those because they didn't have enough fantasy in it. The Magic School Bus was like fantastical. That was hard sci-fi. They shrunk. They went inside a person's bowels one time and I was like, ew.
But you were there for it. So like, here we are talking about it. So.
Arnold turned orange from eating 1700 carrots. And so I tried to turn orange by trying to eat all the carrots. It was
Oh my God.
I was a very strange child. Yeah, surprised to nobody.
Your poor mother. I just to bring it back. I just find that when people of color, when we're doing these analogs, we can even look at Game of Thrones if we want to take the heat off of The Witcher, and we think about where do Black and Indigenous people show up in that world? What kind of iconography is attributed to them and to their bodies and into their civilizations? And it's like, oh, slaves. Like, we could be in the North. Like, why aren't there slaves in the North in the wintery parts? Mm-hmm. But no, we get to the hot climate. Where the black and brown people are, what are they? Slaves. Like that is their defining characteristic. The unsullied. Right. They are unsullied and they are slaves. And I'm just like.
And who saves them? You know, the white lady.
Like with the blonde hair.
Oh.
Because she was also enslaved.
Oh, right. That's right. Oh. By the brown people. Wow. Layers.
By the Arabic coded.
And this is where meta narrative comes in. We can look at something even as recent as the YA novel The Continent, right? Mm-hmm. Which created these analogs for the continent, the two tribes who were violent and lived on the continent. One was, I think, called the Nopi tribe, more like the Nope Out of Here tribe. and then the other one was like Japanese coded, and they wore all black and were very stealthy and silent. So, ninjas.
No comment. I don't know what to say. You know, it's ironic too, because I will tell you, like, you know, obviously, like, I pulled a lot of my influences from Black Sun from the ancestral Puebloans and the Hopi are descendants of the ancestral Puebloans. And they were very sophisticated, you know? I mean, they built like sky rises and they like, you know, followed, you know, they were master astronomers and they built roads and they traded, you know, as far, you know, down to South America and, you know, they had complex religions. And so that's really what I was trying to celebrate, you know, and bring to Black Sun to show that, okay, yeah, people wore loincloths, you know, maybe in like Aztec culture because it was hot.
Yeah, it's fucking hot.
I know. And then when the Europeans came and tried to make them wear clothes, they all got sick, you know, and like, well, European diseases, but they knew what they were doing. You know, they knew, hey, you know what? We wear loincloths, we wear hip skirts, we do these things because it's hot as F and we're sweating. And you make us wear these heavy quilted, you know, European style clothes and we're going to get sick and die.
Full of smallpox.
Yeah, right.
I mean, look at something like in South America, the Inca roads, like the Trail of the Inca, like that was an incredibly complex trail that led, like all roads led back to the center, the heart of the Incan Empire. And so these were very sophisticated technologies, but, you know, shows will tell you that no, aliens made that, because how could indigenous people have created these things and had technology? And when I went to Ecuador, I went to Ingapirca, and they had these like beautiful baths, right? And I'm just like, yes, because our people showered. You know?
It's the lies that we tell about indigenous people, about Black people, about, you know what I mean? It's the lies. Mm-hmm. And then those lies get to be used under the guise of fantasy and say like, oh, so I can make every single brown person who shows up in a fictional universe impoverished and without culture, right? Or backwards. When really these great ancient civilizations, these great civilizations that still have their footprint on this earth are still just as valuable as Greece and Rome and all of the ones that we are forced to learn about, that they are on par doing their own thing.
I'm honestly surprised when people think that like a lot of the Greek and Roman stuff was so like civilized and modernized when wasn't it in Rome? Was it Rome or Greece? I think it was Rome, where the toilets were literally like you go to a house like this building where people sit on this ledge and then they poop and talk to each other while they're pooping. And I was like, oh my God. Cause I was watching these, I've been doing a lot of research on like how people go to the bathroom in ancient history, because in Incendiary, I created a false, it was anachronistic for me to have indoor plumbing, because I wanted her to take baths and like have fancy baths, right? I literally just read a high fantasy where they have flushing toilets, but still dress. Yes. I'm not going to tell you what book it is until we get off of this, this podcast. But I was like, she puked in the toilet and then she flushed it. And I was like, but they're wearing like, she's hunting in the woods and they're, you know, it's like a fairy romp, like, whatever. but that's different than like, oh, here's random brown people that you didn't explain how they got here. Right. And there's no power shifting. But yeah, like, so I like those kinds of I do a lot of research of like how things work, and Danielle mentioned in another podcast episode with Daniel Jose Older about how access to technology also creates power dynamics within fantasy.
Yeah, this idea of, well, I was complaining, which is my thing, about Star Wars and about how do you create civilizations and galaxies far, far away that are devoid of racism, or like, how do you have Latinos in space, right? When there's no Latin America, mm-hmm. right? Like when Black people show up in Star Wars and I'm like, oh, okay. So, but you're going to be okay, you know, because I'm like, oh no. Oh, but your race isn't stigmatized. Okay, cool, cool. But then European iconography, like, cultural touchstones and also Japanese ones seem to be rampant in Star Wars. So I was having a lot of problems. And I was like thinking about worlds and sort of how do I build a secondary world full of people of color and talk about race in ways that they may not analog to now, or they might, but how do I do that? And why is it, if this is a me problem, that I have a problem watching and engaging in, I'm not going to call it colorblind casting, or like where there's like all different kinds of people and there's like no explanation, where I'm like, well, how did these people get here? And we're still got them, you know, some trappings of medieval Europe, but then we've got this and that. Again, this is a messy Witcher. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Rebecca, on Netflix.
I have seen it actually.
Okay, watched so it you know what I'm talking about. Right. So you know what I'm talking about, where it's like, okay, there's a Black man and he's got on like this outfit and he's in here in this multicultural cosmopolitan city. Then you've got the Wakandans that come in at some point with the dragon, and then you got the people in the wood. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't make sense of it, and it was bothering me. And I thought, do I just have a failure of imagination that I can't understand in a secondary world how you can have a cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, multiracial city without talking about race, where it just exists? Everybody's just there.
I mean, races can exist. They just don't have to fight in that moment, right?
I'm not looking for a fight. I'm looking for a commentary. I'm looking for where they came from. I'm looking for a texture. I'm looking for...
Yeah.
Do you know who does this really well, shows different different areas? Roseanne Brown in A Song of Rights and Ruin.
Mm-hmm.
There are different countries, and they're all emerging in the cosmos. This, like, to me, it felt more like a multicultural city center where people are trying to pass through these gates, and you can see the different cultures. Like, everyone is still coded as a Black person or a brown person, but within that race, like, you have different cultures and different kingdoms, and you can actively feel that in the text.
Yes. And I tried to do that in Black Sun. Like, you have, you know, it's divided into city states. So you have like the Kwikolans, and Kwikola is like a very sort of cosmopolitan merchant city, but when one of the characters who is Teak, who is an outsider to that culture, who exists in it, comes, you know, like, well, she's a sea captain, so she's there in jail. We meet her when she's in jail, sleeping off a night on the town. you know, there's a lot of prejudice against her. There's some suspicions, you know, and it's not that she's a different race per se, although you do find out she has some magical abilities, and that's really, you know, what people are afraid of. But that you know, there is variety within this world, even though everyone is coded brown in one way or another, you know, that you can have different ethnic groups, you can have different cultures. It doesn't have to all be set up exactly like, you know, America, our racial social hierarchy is. You can do other things with it, and then you can make commentary, you can give that texture, I think, that you're looking for, Danielle, without sort of resorting to our existing class structure and social structure.
Yep. I'm a texture whore. I feel like that's my problem. It's like, that's what I come in looking for. I'm like,
but you know, That is good world building, though. And I think that sort of circles around to what we were talking about before, when maybe sometimes, yeah, you can't just slap the brown paint on people. You have to give them texture. You have to give them depth. You have to take the time and do the work to build out the culture, even if it is a secondary culture, even if, you know, for me, I try to really avoid these one-on-one analogs. I think it's lazy. You know, yeah. I think we can do much better than that. And so it requires work, you know, it requires research, and it requires not just changing the first letter of a native nation to you know, fill in for something else. So,
yeah. And I think we also have to work on educating ourselves, right? Like, so if you're building a world, and that goes for people of color, indigenous people, black people, like everyone, if you're trying to create worlds that are not based in European history, iconography, their worldview, you have to do the work of understanding what that is, right? Because me, as you know, I shouldn't be running into using, you know what I mean, analogs that I don't understand, cultures that I don't understand. And I always wondered, and I was talking to Zoraida about this maybe a week or two ago, about the weird position of being a Black American, sort of divorced from my African ancestry, but like an amalgamated African, like living outside of a culture I have no understanding of, but having my own weird, very young culture, right? And trying to create worlds, secondary worlds, right? I said, do Black Americans and Black fantasy, does it always have to be contemporary fantasy? Will I ever be able to put myself in the epic? Is there a way to do a Game of Thrones, a Black American Game of Thrones, or a Black one, where I'm using culture from this very young Black American culture that came out of slavery, right? That was built literally by that breaking, and create big epic analogs. And I just was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do it. Like, and it was like a crisis that I was having about how I create echoes and how I build worlds and the resonance that they have, when all of the other big worlds, big ticket worlds that have just been so pervasive from Tolkien to, you know, George R. R. Martin,
the question of
time, like all borrow on civilizations and culture and history that was so long ago, that is so long and pervasive, the empire. Essentially.
Right.
And I just was like, fuck.
So my question is, this is going to sound rude, what is actually cultural about Game of Thrones?
They use the War of the Roses. That's what.
Okay.
But
there's no like, but there's no like Christian real, you know, is like the, to me, like Europe is a Christian analog, right? Like, Not all of Europe, but Britain, right? Britain is a Christian analog. I guess the North has some like Celtic-y very things much with the ravens. It's in just when tree. I read it, it just feels like...
In Scandinavian.
It feels like, you know what it is? I guess because it's done so much, it just feels like fantasy, like general fantasy.
That's what
and
I'm saying.
And I hate saying that term.
But that is the that is the default. Like,
the default.
Whiteness is the default of a person when we encounter them in text. I feel like when I walk into a fantasy world, I'm fighting against medieval European analog, because that's all I know from what I was reading growing up until I discovered Octavia Butler, right? And then it's like, oh, this is new.
But I had the same problems when I wrote Incendiary, even though Incendiary is supposed to be a Spanish analog. And people would be like, I've already seen this world done already. And I'm like, you've seen a lot of Spanish fantasy? Like, point me to it, right? Like, point me to somewhere where all of the names are coded in Spanish. And I've read this for other books. Like, one of my favorite books was Woven in Moonlight by Isabel Ibanez, because I've never read a book before during that time period. I hadn't read a book that uses Bolivian cultural touchstones, and they're so similar to the Andes in Ecuador that I was like, oh my God, this is the first time I'm seeing this. This is crazy. And so I have a hard time writing in it because I'm thinking like, what am I allowed to write? The same way that Danielle is, right? Like if I'm from a place, but I don't belong necessarily to that cultural piece, how do I create a fantasy? Like, what am I entitled to write? What am I entitled to create?
That's hard.
I think that's a good question. Yeah, I think all artists question that. But I think, you know, well, maybe not the white ones. I don't know. You know, I think we put this pressure on ourselves, particularly as like writers of color, because we're so worried about our own sort of like what our communities will say, you know, and we're so worried also about like what the larger world will say. Is this going to sell? Because we, you know, we are trying to make a living as well, you know, so you have sort of your artistic, you know, sort of vision, and you have the commercial thing. And then you have, what about the cultural issues? And I think, you know, for me, I try to write with integrity. I try to write, you know, the truth that I know, and then I try to be brave. And I think that those are really the only things you can do, because whether you do it or not, you will get criticism, right? If you don't do it, people are like, well, why are you writing this? If you do do it, then they're like, well, you can't write that. So you just have to write what feels true to you. And then, you know, sort of let the chips fall where they may. And I also feel that, you know, time tells as well. Often when you are a pioneer or you're at the vanguard of what you are doing, you sort of suffer the sort of slings, I guess, of coming through the door first. And then you're going to get pummeled for that. But there will be people who read your book, people of your background, or people, you know, for me, like other Indigenous readers who read it and see themselves just like you did, Zoraida, in that other book for the first time in genre, in fantasy. And that matters. And in 5 years, that will matter more. And then in 10 years. So I think we often have to take the long view too. And you have the voice and you have the creativity and you are blessed with those things, and you have to use them to be a storyteller. And I think that's the primary call of the artist.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's my speech.
I love it. It's a good speech. It's a good speech. And, you know, I really think it's important for us to like figure out the stories we want to tell, right? In the worlds we want to build and the worlds we didn't get to see. And that's what I love about Black Sun, is that it's a triumphant world. It's a world that has twists and turns and like such good texture and detail. One I'm terrified of. I know I won't survive this world, but I want to be in it like forever. And I wish that I had read this book when my brain was forming, when I was falling in love with fantasy. Because I think that when we fall in love with fantasy, whether it's, you know, that 13, 14, 15 year old self, when I was reading these huge tomes, like weekly, if I could have seen other ways to build worlds that didn't rely on the same tools to create that default, I think that my imagination would be a completely different. It would just be completely different now.
I didn't start reading high fantasy until college, because when I read fantasy in high school, I read urban fantasy, right? I read a contemporary fantasy. I read the magic is layered on top of our world, and here's my vampire boyfriend. And Natalie Parker and I had to reread a lot of those vampire books when we did our Vampires Never Get Old podcast. And the one thing I noticed that was also pervasively absent of people of color, you know? And so I think that shaped a lot of how I wrote my very first story that never got published. And so it feels like an education, a re-education of looking at a world and even pushing myself to write outside of a European context. We are not saying that like European fantasy is bad and that, you know, everything other kind of fantasy should have no critical analysis, right? Like we can write something, I can still love a book and critique it, right?
Yes.
For me, my new job is to push myself into truly taking up the word fantasy and what that means. Mm. Fantastic, like the impossibility of worlds, because we have like a blank slate to create everything. So then why just create an analog of the real world and copy and paste our real problems, unless that is something that I want to do and talk about it on that page, right? What kind of story am I trying to tell? And I've been thinking a lot about that as I try to figure out a plot for my next book.
And I think, you know, both of those approaches are valid. You know, like sometimes you want to write the critique of our culture, and then sometimes you want to be fantastical and step outside what already exists. Like one of the things I always say in sort of the endeavor of what we call Indigenous futurisms, which is, you know, sort of a take on Afrofuturisms, and then sort of Indigenous science fiction and fantasy, is you can work within the colonial narrative where you have, you know, invasion and conquest and those sorts of things, and tell your story there as a sort of a critique of what has happened, of history and what the ongoing, you know, situation with like Indigenous folks. Or you could step outside that entirely and create a world that is not in conversation with colonization and the history of that. And create sort of your own world, drawing from Indigenous cultures and drawing from your own history. And so I think I do a little bit of both. I tend to veer towards the second one. I want to create a world where it's really just a celebration of Indigenous imagination often. And sort of the way you were talking about, Zoraida, the fantastic. I want to create, you know, that sense of the fantastic so that I could put mermaids in my world and I could put crow gods in my world. And I could do all these things that people might be like, oh no, that's too, you know, those belong to Europeans. Like, who says, you know, I can do whatever I want. And I think that's very exciting. And I think also, you know, when you talk about, you know, interrogating structures, power structures, you know, we can interrogate gender as well. You know, one of the things I really tried to do was, and I thought was really true to Indigenous thinking, was to have more than two genders in my world. You know, there's a third gender, and then there's people who are non-binary. And then there's disability in my world that looks different. People are treated not the way that Western people treat people with disabilities, as some sort of like social burden or something, but that, and it's true to sort of Mayan culture that, yeah, disability was often revered. It meant you had been touched by God. And so, you know, it was something, it was not something, you know, that was looked down on in the same sense that we tend to look down on it in our culture. It was something that could be celebrated.
Which I love. It's just a deep consideration. And I think that that's what I'm looking for. In my fantasy, this deep, deep well of consideration, pushing the world, pushing what we've seen, what we know, what we don't know, all of the nooks and crannies. And that's why I'm a huge fan. and I'm like, take me to your masterclass, because I would love to sit in a room and talk to you about all of this stuff that most people probably say is like super nerdy. But I'm like, I just want to think through my worlds at a level, or get close to how you do it, and just like really expand. And it comes from reading you and from reading other wonderful writers, and pushing myself to say, what if in a deeper, more profound way, and not being afraid to take a risk. I'm very, very risk averse.
Yes.
And as a fantasy writer, it is a risk to, you're like, oh, I could just do the thing that meet people where they are, right? Mm-hmm. Do the thing that I know will bring the reader that is outside of my community as well, you know, and make some sacrifices for the reader that is inside my community. And I realize, no, I need to just stick to my guns. Draw my line in the sand. That's really hard. It really is. Yeah. Hard.
I felt like Black Sun was very risky. Like when I wrote it, I was like, this might not work. You know, like people might not like my use of neo pronouns. You know, it might not, you know, you might read it and be like, I don't get it. I don't know what's going on. And I've had a few readers, particularly like my number one review on Amazon, of course, is some dude be like, I don't like neo pronouns. And I was like, well, there you go. But, you know, so that felt risky. Of course, you know, I usually don't have white people in my stories. That feels risky. Yeah. And so just all these sort of levels of what I was trying to do, even like things like the loincloth, I will come back to that because that felt really risky. Like, shouldn't I put them all in pants? You know, because I know the stereotype and I know what people are thinking. And I was like, yeah, no, but the Aztecs wore loincloths, you know, right. And they looked good doing it. So
I didn't
put that in the book.
We want the sexy loincloth.
I know.
Listen, and the very good thighs, I feel like our people have very good thighs.
Exactly. And the skin tone is nice. The psoriasis of muscles, and it's like these muscly
look
men in the loincloths. And like, I only made the joke about the loincloths because when any white writer writes in Black or Indigenous people, they have this, they've hijacked an iconography.
And it's that Tarzan, the Tarzan problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I feel like it goes back to Tarzan and the Jungle Book and these narratives that have like become so entrenched into our iconography of what it means to live in a jungle climate, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing some research for my adult magical realism book that comes out in the fall. And it's just like copy editing stuff. I needed to look at a statue that's in Ecuador. And I showed it to Danielle because the Huancavilca Indians that lived in the region that is Guayaquil, everyone thinks that they're Inca, but they were actually the people that were there before the Incas, right? And they're depicted in their traditional garb. And I'm like, have you ever been to Guayaquil in like peak heat? Like 98 degrees and humid. Yeah. Nobody's wearing fucking petticoat or whatever it is.
I mean, right. Right.
So true. Like, just like you said, like it's hot. We know why we're wearing these things, but then you go to the mountains in the Andes, you're, you know, higher than Colorado, right? Mm-hmm. The elevation, and it's cold. So right. The clothing reflects the, you know, they use alpaca wool, right? Mm-hmm. And all of these things. And so all of this, man, it's just, I have so many feelings.
Feelings. It's a lot of feelings. And being, you know what I mean? We're writing, trying to write from our well, right? The mm-hmm. well that is us. It's hard when we watch that well be contaminated or pulled from and abused. Right before we even get a chance to like do something beautiful.
What are our pitfalls? What are the things that we should be wary about? Because we know, do the research, pull from your well, do write with, you know, be brave, all of the beautiful things Rebecca said in the beginning of the podcast, right? What are our pitfalls though? Like what do we want to avoid on the road to our fantasy fields?
Like what's the dog shit not to step in on the way?
All the horse shit.
To the horse shit. While
the unicorn shit. Excuse me, it's unicorns. We have unicorns in Deadline City. Okay. Canon.
Okay. I'll give one. I think that when we're trying to write non-European coded fantasy, what, you know, thinking deeply and doing the study of sort of that history of that iceberg and trying to present something, especially if it's something, you know, still, when I write about my own people, I am very careful. I try to think through how have all of these things that I'm going to be writing about in the book been used against have stigmatized my group, and try to think through that so that I know the thorns, and then I run straight into them and say like, how can I like, how
I mean,
can
you know
I,
what they say, Danielle, you know what they say, every rose has its thorn.
I don't like it.
No.
Rebecca, save me.
Just like every cowboy has a sad song.
Oh, no.
I haven't sung to you in so long since we were in the car today and I was singing the thong song to her.
Oh, no.
See, Rebecca? You see
that? And she wouldn't let me turn up the volume. She just turned it back down. I was really upset.
Yeah. Yeah.
I felt censured.
Your first rights amendments.
I know, right?
Yes. I run straight into the thorns once I understand what they are to give dignity and write the thing that a piece of the culture that I felt like I was missing when my imagination was growing, the thing that I wish that I saw. I try to do that to create understanding and also like that I see you. So that there are readers who are like, oh my God, I saw what you did. Like you left me a breadcrumb. I try to do that. Not everyone can do that, but that's what I try to do. But you can step in. That can be a whole pile of dog shit if you don't know what you're doing. So like, don't write about stereotypes unless you actually understand the history and where they come from and understand the beauty of the culture.
Yeah, I mean, I agonize over sentences about my own people because I'm like, if somebody reads this and takes it the wrong way, like, am I writing something because it's true or because it's a stereotype that my family uses? Am I writing something, you know? And so I think about that a lot. And half of the time I'll end up either removing a sentence or leaving it in because it feels like a part of somebody's voice. But I strive to be intentional with what I write. And learning to be intentional is a very long road because sometimes you think you're just writing to create worlds and to be imaginative and to write something that means so much to you because you have something to say. But sometimes you have to learn that not everything you say is correct, right? And so like it's everything is a journey about learning how the world works and uncovering your own privilege, your own biases and things like that. And you don't know what you don't know, and which is why I think that like we should be as writers on a constant journey of education. Whether it's learning about other cultures, I learned so much from Danielle about the culture of being a troll.
I knew she was going to say that because I know she was going to say Black American culture because she went to basically a Black school in Queens. So she knows and gospel songs. Like she knows a lot. I knew she was going to say troll. I teach you our troll ways. Yeah.
Well, and also Southern Black American culture. So you've taught me a lot about that.
I have.
Black culture outside of Queens, New York, which is expansive.
Yes.
So it's, I think that's something that I would like our listeners who are afraid to write their own stories, their own fantasy worlds. And another one would be, it's be wary of saying like, I'm just going to put a different race of people into another culture. Like I'm going to take Russian people, but make them samurai, or I'm going to take Canadians and make them.
Why would you even bring up Canada?
You don't even know. Canada's not a culture. It's a culture of politeness, I guess.
Poutine.
Or denial.
Oh my God. Yeah. We're going to get so many angry
comments. I'm going to cut that.
Yes.
It's like Americans are so racist. And then you have Canada having a Trump march. Okay, Canada. Or taking like Greek people and putting them in the Arctic, right? Like, I think that's not just strange. And I'm not saying it couldn't happen, right? Like what if Greece froze over? Like what do people do now? Right? What happens to an island culture where when you can't fish, you become, I guess, I was gonna say Fjordans, and I'm like, that's a fake fantasy world from Shadow and Bone. What is the real word? Scandinavians.
Oh my God. This is the dark road that I live on. The Cordova. This is how we spiral into the rabbit hole.
That was,
well, you know, actually, Zoraida, I think
even for me,
I think that's sort of interesting. Actually, if you said, what if Greece sort of froze over, then what happens to the culture? I think that's a very different sort of take than let's just put sort of Greece culture in the north, in the icy north, and see what happens, you know?
Right. Like, yeah.
Because that's about, you know, adaptation, and that's about, you know, so that becomes science fiction, right? Like that becomes, you know, climate, and you could do all sorts of interesting things with that, actually. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're not a mess. It made total sense to me.
You're so nice.
Thank you for taking my mental jumps with me. I feel like my mind is like a bunny on like LSD, right? It's just like beep, 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 beep. I remember the first time I met Rebecca at a bar in, where were we? Aspen?
Oh, Beaver Creek. Yes, Colorado. Yeah,
Colorado. And I just sat next to her and I said, are you Rebecca Roanhorse?
Did you? I don't know. Is that you?
That was me.
Yes. No, I know. It was you and Victoria.
Yeah.
Schwab. The bar in Beaver Creek. Yeah.
Yeah.
You stalked Rebecca, didn't you? You were like,
no.
We were all there for the Sirens convention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was before my book even came out. My first novel even came out. I was carrying around a bunch of ARCs that didn't even have covers yet.
You gave one to me.
Oh, did I? Yeah. I was like, hi, here's my book. So bad. But Victoria and Zoraida were so nice, and they invited me to sit with them and have a drink, and they just, you know, treated me like I was not, you know, some newbie wannabe author. They treated me like a peer. So I've never forgotten that. It was so kind.
I love it, because it's like, you're like, oh, now it's like you are the Rebecca Roanhorse. Put the in front of the name. Like, put the respect on your name, okay? The respect on your name.
Unless it's like that Rebecca Roanhorse.
Oh, it's that Rebecca Roanhorse.
No, it's the thing. It's the. No, I just, yeah, I just love, I'm a auto buy Rebecca Roanhorse girl.
Aww.
I'm like, oh, there's a new book. Let me get that. And I just, your world and your world building are masterful. And I'm serious. Like, if you ever taught a class, even if it was 101, I would still come and audit it just to think through how, because you use the smallest detail work in order to pay off. Like, you use small things that pay off in volumes and telegraph certain things from your clothing choices in Black Sun. And their word choices and sort of their relationships, like, told me so much about the power structure. And I was like, oh, this is masterful. And I was stressed. So it was like, who's going to survive and who's not? I just think that if you want to try to write fantasy world without the heavy influence of European iconography and lore and history, you are like top on the syllabus for that. Because you've just done an amazing, amazing job. And I feel like our listeners have learned so much from...
I'll say one thing, like, just for your listeners, that all that little detail work matters. You know, all of that adds to your world building. So don't get lazy about, like, what foods people might eat. You know, people are going to eat different foods than your typical European foods. And then what are foods are actually European, like potatoes, tomatoes, so many things. Those are actually from the Americas, you know, so they're not really in medieval Europe. So, you know, even little details like that, they all matter. They all go into the bigger pot of world building. Hairstyles, you know, what jewelry might be made of. All these tiny things, even word choice, like you said, it adds so much to character, like how one character might speak versus another. And that's where you can really get some of that texture and richness as well, is in the minutiae. And it might seem like, who cares? Are people going to read over that? But it all adds up. It all adds to the story. So don't put flushing toilets in your story, please. And like, let people eat the correct foods.
I love it. Yes, that was something that jumped out to me in one fantasy book, which will not be named, but there were people that were in a Caribbean-esque world that were eating crepes. And I'm like, this is like an analog for like Jamaica, honey. Like, you know what I mean? Where's the cassava? Where's the, you know what I mean? Like, it's hot. So it's hot. So let's look at what dessert is eaten in a hot, you know, hot place without colonization, bringing a crepe from France.
Hey, and there's so much joy in that. It's so much fun. Like, I did all this research on indigenous foods and you know, what one eats, you know, traditional foods along the Yucatan Peninsula, and, you know, traditional Pueblo foods. And it's so exciting and fun. Like, don't rob yourself of that experience either as an author. Like, it takes a little bit of more work, but it's so cool when you go, oh, I didn't even know there were mangrove oysters. You can get, you know, oysters, and it was just really neat. So anyway,
I love it. I love it. And thank you so much for coming to Deadline City and discussing, you know, fantasy and worlds and analogs and culture and all of that stuff with us. We've had a blast. And
thank you for
having our shenanigans.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you so much. All right, that's it for this week's episode of Deadline City. Thank you so, so much for listening to us. Our goal is to demystify the publishing and writing process and count on listeners like you for your support. So don't forget to review, comment, subscribe, and chat with us on our Twitter and Instagram Deadline City accounts. If you like what you hear, buy us a coffee on Ko-fi or join our Patreon community. So see you next week, and for now, write on. Deadline City is part of the Frolic Podcasts Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts.